Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. And I'm Dr. Lisa. How are you doing today? I want to tell you something. I just came back from South Africa. Can you believe it? South Africa, I saw animals. I saw two herds of elephants at one time. Can you believe that? Anyway, it was great to be away. I'm glad to be back. I haven't done the show live for a while, so I'm a little bit like, I hope I get it together. I hope I can get this together. Also, because I'm actually, my guest today is a very, very, very talented and highly trained professional actor, performer, writer, comedian. So it's a little extra pressure. Hi, Ken Perlstein.
Hi.
Do you think I'm going to get it together?
I think we're going to get through this together. Like,
you do?
Wonder Twin Powers activate. Here we are.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to like make sure that, like, you know, you're going to help me hit the marks and everything.
I got your
You're
back.
The professional. You're the professional here.
I'm a professional acting like a professional is what I'm doing.
You wore your Jimmy Kimmel Live shirt. It's a little intimidating, you know?
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little intimidating because, you know, I'm like thinking, well, he was probably on Jimmy Kimmel Live, and now, why did you fucking agree to be on the show, you idiot?
Why did I agree to be on the show? No, I've never been on Jimmy Kimmel Live. And,
okay. So
my wife is very good friends with one of the producers.
Oh, nice. So, and you haven't been on? You've got to make that work. You've got.
I will.
You have watched the show, right?
Of course, we've been. We've been there when he's.
Oh,
done.
You've been there live.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
That's a great show.
More than once.
Couple times.
Oh, cool. Okay, so here's the thing, guys. Back to you. Back to you, the listener, in your luxurious room, porch overlooking the ocean. They used to be in basements, but now you guys have worked your way up. So I just want to tell you how I know Ken and why he's here, what we're going to talk about. So I met Ken Perlstein in 2009 when I was taking a comedy class. And Ken was taking a comedy class. Obviously, it worked out for him. And I'm, and I just turned into a self-proclaimed psychotherapist. That's another story. So the thing is that, I started thinking about Ken again because Ken has a recurring role on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is so impressive to me. And then even just a couple of weeks ago, my husband and I were watching Succession in bed, and there was Ken on the TV again. Did you know you were in the room with, did you have, you didn't know
I had
that.
No idea I was in bed with you and your husband.
We were really tired, so nothing, it was very.
Nothing happened.
We have a king-size bed. It was really wholesome.
There's plenty of room.
Very wholesome, Tim, plenty of room.
You know, my wife and I have a king-size, and, we reach out long distance.
Yeah, I don't think, I want to tell you something, kids. I don't think I resisted getting a king-size bed. When I was younger, I had a king-size bed with my boyfriend, and I just don't think it's good. I think it's very unromantic, but that's my opinion. What do you think?
You know, it depends.
It depends.
It depends.
Well, for me, if you're ever going to, for me. Just anyway, check in on that before you get
one. Craigslist party, and,
So I want to tell you a little more about Ken. I want to let you know that he is like a very highly trained actor. He has an MFA from the Actor Studio. He does comedy around the city. He like at least probably once a week, which is a big fucking deal. He's making a living as an actor. I printed out his resume and it's like, it's really, it's very professional. Very, very. I see HBO. I see CBS, Showtime, Amazon, Bank Street Theater, Actor Studio, stuff like that. So he's the real deal, folks. But what we really want to talk about today is the TV pilot that our friend Ken, we're friends now, right?
We've been friends.
We've been friends, right?
Yes. Yes.
We're friends.
We're learning a whole lot more today.
Anyway, my friend here, Ken, who's very successful in entertainment. Ken has written a pilot and produced. He's gotten it produced. He's already in a festival and all this other stuff. And I've seen the trailer for the pilot. I have all the information posted about the pilot and everything else. And there's a GoFundMe, which you should go to, or how it's called. The title of the pilot, the TV pilot, soon to be series, right, Ken? Yes. Soon to be series.
Yes.
It's called How Am I Doing? Yes. There's no question mark in that. And the website is howamidoingtv.com. So you should go there and, you know, you should. This is going to be really good and really valuable to a lot of people, and I think you should donate some money. And while we're talking about donating money, see, I got all nervous and I forgot to ask you to. I'm in trouble now because I forgot to tell people to donate money to our radio station.
You got to take care of the station first. Yeah, you got to keep an office.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm Dr. Yes. Lisa. I'm here every Thursday, 2 to 3. You know, right now we're actually, we have this really amazing deal if you want to do your own podcast recording, okay? So you can just go to our website, radiofreebrooklyn.org, and you can get a 20% discount if you put in my show code, which is DLG for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. And they do everything. Like, it's the kind of thing, folks, honestly, you're like, I want to do a podcast. I don't know anything on how to do a podcast, but I just know I want to do it. So for like very, very, like you, even you can afford it. And then you come here and you get like your own tech guy and you could do anything. And they have, you know, whatever you want, whatever. Anyway, okay. So back to Ken. And so I just want to give you the basic plot of Ken's show so we can get right to talking with Ken. But it's basically about, it's about a middle-aged actor, Eli Meyer, who is struggling. He wants to be an actor. He's struggling with this dream of being an actor.
He wants to come back to an acting career that he had.
And do you want to tell us about it? You could tell us, but you have to tell it to us really quickly.
Okay. He was a regular working actor, had a drinking problem, went to rehab. He was married before, with a daughter. And even after rehab, you know, his marriage didn't work out. And so he's been struggling. It's been kind of dry for him. His agent is struggling. So he has an agent she's selling essential oils on the side. And, you know, his ex-wife is now engaged to a heart surgeon.
A heart surgeon.
A prominent heart surgeon who's kind of moving in on their life, moving in on him and his daughter. And so it's really, he's just trying to get everything.
And he has a daughter.
Yes.
How old is his daughter? What's
11.
What's the deal with his daughter?
Her name's Becca, and she's played by this amazing actress, Samara Conley.
She's really adorable.
She's, every person in this pilot is just fantastic. So
yeah, it is really good.
And I cast all of them.
No, and you wrote it. No, it's good. It has a pretty great singular vision. And the vision is based on your actual life to some degree.
A lot of my life and then a lot of people's lives that I know, different stories things.
So you had an addiction problem.
I still do. I haven't graduated.
Haven't graduated.
Still
in recovery. You're in the program.
Yes, I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been in this program 22 years in June.
22 years.
I got sober after my first year in the MFA program.
Oh, after the Actor's Studio.
After my first year in it, yes.
Wow. See, art can save your life.
Yes, it can.
It can.
And it can take your life.
Right. So you had a drinking problem. You had a divorce, right? I'm saying, there's a lot of parallels.
There's a lot of things, yeah.
There's a lot of parallels here.
Got married after. I've been married in sobriety, divorced in sobriety. I've lost things in sobriety. Had great things happen in sobriety. So it's sobriety's a day at a time, and it's a roller coaster.
Mm-hmm.
And with Eli Meyer, that's his life.
Mm-hmm. Right, what you know. But I think, what... you know, when we were talking about a little bit before we went on the air, and at the end of the day, what's great is how, you know, I said to Ken, so if I say your life is great, your life looks great now. You know, you've got a nice wife, a great kid. His face lit up. I'm telling you, when I mentioned how's your, you know, you have a son, like Ken's crazy about his son. You don't need to be a therapist to see it.
And he drives me crazy, too.
He's making a living as an actor. Do you get recognized on the street?
Sometimes.
Occasionally.
Get recognized in places,
like, yeah. He's killing it, man. But it took him 20 years. So we're going to find out. Today, I want to talk to Ken about where he started and what he went through, because he's killing it now. And I said to him, Ken, your life looks really good. Is it really good? And he said, go ahead. What'd you say?
I said on Facebook, everything looks good.
No, that was
my
modesty.
My life is really good. Honestly, it's a joke. But in all honesty, my life is good. I'm full.
Mm-hmm.
I'm full. And I'm very lucky to have what I have.
And yeah, you said you were grateful, actually, is what he said.
Very grateful.
After I called him out for making a joke. But I also think that he has been through a lot, and I think that art is a struggle, and I think that's what we're going to find out today, hopefully. So this is uplifting, okay? There's something dark about it, but it's got a happy fucking ending. All right, kids?
It does.
So I want to start out, I mean, I personally, you know, it's funny because I'm just going to tell you here's my counter transference, okay, folks? So I drink like one or two drinks a day, and that's more than I'd like to be drinking. It's not like a hardcore alcoholic, but it's a weird place to be because I do know that a lot of people become very successful and have more productive. I wonder if I would be happier or have a more productive life. And it's hard for me to quit drinking. I mean, and also because it's not ruining my life. I'm just curious about it. And also, the way I was brought up, no one drank in my family. And I am phobic about throwing up. I've mentioned this before on air, but I didn't drink at all until I moved to New York at age, like I didn't drink till after I'd been in New York for a year at age 23. So I didn't drink in college. I didn't know anything about drinking. I didn't realize like I would have actually probably had sex in college if I'd drank. I had very little sex. My own room, no sex. And alcohol would have solved that. But anyway, that's history. So I just want to, so I am very curious and I'm going to ask some naive questions.
Okay.
So how did you, like, what happened? When did you start drinking? Like, how did you wind up in that kind of situation?
I mean, my first drink was when I was a little kid because it was always around me.
Mm-hmm.
So really my first drink was at 5, you know, starting at, you know, with sips of scotch or booze, sips of beer.
So there was drinking in your family.
Yeah.
And then like, what about high school?
Yeah, high school, there was a, we moved around quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
We moved around a lot.
Uh-huh. Why was that?
Yeah, my dad was in commercial real estate at the time, shopping centers. And,
was he doing well?
Yeah, he was doing really well. And he worked at a lot of different places that, you know, wanted his expertise.
So, but he'd have a drink at night and whatever.
Yeah,
there was alcohol around. I had no alcohol.
There was some, you know.
He approved of alcohol. I was like, alcohol is evil. Well, we were brought up differently, and we're both Jews. So, okay. So he moved around for his job, and his job was a good, stable job, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And, but like when, you know, like when did drinking become a regular part of your life?
Well, I mean, we lived in Maryland for 10 years, and so that's where I really, you know, did a lot of growing up there. But I was also in special education for 16 and a half years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in the 70s, when we were diagnosed as, you know, ADD and dyslexia, they didn't know how to handle that.
Right.
So the answer was Ritalin and resource rooms. The RRs, double
resource
R.
Resource rooms?
Ritalin and resource rooms.
What are those?
Those are special classes, what they call them. Yes.
Okay.
Right?
So, when they make you run around and get some of those,
right,
whatever.
Right. Uh-huh. So that's, you know, that was mm-hmm. our thing. My brother and I were athletes growing up.
Mm-hmm.
The Jew jocks.
Mm-hmm.
Those are Jews who play sports but don't own the teams.
So that's what a Jew jock I like is. That.
But growing up, I never went to the same school in my neighborhood.
Ah.
I never went to the same school because I had to go to schools that had a special ed program, so to speak.
Ah.
So it was tough. So relating to people my age, my neighborhood, relating to anybody for me, I always felt like an outsider. But I always had a good relationship with the older kids in my neighborhood.
And
that's where I drank with them. I would start when I got to, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15, I was drinking with them.
So you were hanging out with the older kids.
Yeah, hanging out with the older kids, drinking, smoking weed, but hanging mm-hmm. out with them. I'd say my last, we ended up moving to Atlanta. Supposed to be my last couple of years in high school. I also was held back a few times, so I don't even, God mm-hmm. knows. My parents got my brother and I into a boarding school in Maine. I didn't drink when I was up there.
Why did they send you to a boarding school?
Just to get away from, you know, the home. Give us a, you know.
They thought that it was
a good program.
It would be a good thing for you.
It was a very good school.
Then your parents could afford it, and it was a good opportunity, probably.
It was a good opportunity, good school,
yeah.
And it was away from home, mm-hmm. and it's a great school in Bath, Maine.
Right. So you and your brother were at least had each other, though.
Yeah, you know, we had each other, you know, and yeah. It was a small school.
So you didn't drink at all there?
No, I did not. Not while I was at the school. So, you know, we played three sports a year, and we were obligated. Everybody had to participate in performing arts.
Mm-hmm.
Even the teachers, even the headmaster participated in the performing arts. We had a show in the spring.
Were you always interested in performing arts?
I had always had a knack for characters and voices
mm-hmm.
throughout my life.
And sing
invitations.
Well also.
I did, yes.
Yeah,
But I could always do impersonations. I was mm-hmm. used to impersonate people I worked for, teachers,
mm-hmm.
everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what I wanted to do. My academics were horrendous.
Mm-hmm.
But they found out I could sing. They got me into their show, their yearly mm-hmm. show that they did.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of people, they just wrote it on the spot. And
you seem like you'd be a natural on stage as a kid.
I was shy. I was so shy, but they made me sing. And, uh-huh. You know, the thing about this school is that it's based on character development, and they really don't kick people out for breaking the rules. What they do is they make you work it off. They put you on work crew.
Mm.
So when they asked me to, you know, hey, we want you to sing this part in a show, and I told them to go F themselves, and I'm not going to sing. They said, well, you can chip ice instead. So I sang.
Mm-hmm.
And I just found something.
You enjoy it. It kind of felt right to you.
It felt right to me. It just felt right. It was where I was home,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't academic, really. You know,
right.
I didn't have to add or subtract.
Right. Which, you know, Ken, you're obviously. I mean, this is the thing about dyslexia and stuff like that. You're obviously a very, very bright man, and people like. It wasn't like you really had a learning disability. You just couldn't learn the way you needed to learn for that.
Right. We learned differently, and it, you know. So
which
that's
is why you wound up going to a really good school. You went to, I have it right here. Where'd you go to school? College.
I ended up, you know, they got me into Marshall University.
Yeah, it's a good school.
It's a good school, and they also, one of the reasons I got into was they had a, what's called the HELP program, and it's a really good, really good program still going on today.
Mm-hmm.
It's higher education for people with learning disabilities.
Oh.
And it's really grown. It's one of the best programs for that in the country today.
That's so really good to hear that.
Yeah, I walked on, played Division I football, walked on for a little bit, and I was a theater major.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that so you
and
did
I was
you
in a fraternity,
well?
So I did everything.
Oh, fraternity. So did you do well?
It took me Because you have to take other classes too in college.
Yeah.
It took me 5 years, including summer schools and a theater professor to say, you know what? Get the heck out of Huntington, West Virginia. There's nothing for you here.
Mm-hmm.
Get out.
Mm-hmm.
Go to New York.
Mm-hmm.
Go to New York.
So he encouraged you.
Yes.
And did you, I'm guessing that you were doing well there in like that. Was obvious that you had talent.
I did okay. A lot of the plays that they did there were, for the most part, they were called restoration comedies.
Mm-hmm.
So I would always play the little, you know, the character guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until they had, because we were directors too, it wasn't until they had a little festival
mm-hmm.
that, and I was, you know, cast in something pretty deep mm-hmm. that they're like, oh my God, you can act too? Wow. And it was in my senior year. I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess I can. And they said, one of my professors said the best place for you is in New York.
It's great that you were able to access something that allowed you to, like, really develop, you know, the best part of you, really, and to express yourself and to get confidence. That's why art is so important, people, because it helps.
Art isn't easy.
So, what about drinking in college? Did you drink in college?
Oh, yeah. I was a blackout drinker.
And how did that get in your way? Or
a lot of things got in my way. And, you know, I went to CODA, you know, Codependence Anonymous in college. I went to Adult Children of Alcoholics. I just didn't admit that I had a problem. Deep down, I did. But I was, you know, I blew a lot of opportunities because of my drinking in college. I burned bridges, did a
with
lot of things
people.
I can't even remember. People, places, and things. I can't even, I mean, look, years later, a friend of mine from college hit me up on Facebook. He said, hey, you remember when we were working at this place and you did this? I'm like, what? And it was something ridiculous that got me fired, but it was just something that, like, God, I don't remember that.
Because you were probably drunk.
Of course, yeah.
And what about the chicks? Did you have any chicks? Did you get any in college?
Get any chicks? Well, you know, a Jew boy, an ethnic looking, you know, athletic Jew boy in college. I wasn't, and my self esteem, first of all, my self esteem was crap.
Uh huh.
It was crap, and I had no self esteem.
Yeah.
So I wasn't prepared for the attention I got from West Virginia girls.
Oh, so the girls liked you.
The West Virginia girls liked me. We are the Jew boy. Ding, 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 ding.
Guy that's funny, can make funny voices, woo, can sing. I mean, who doesn't want that?
We got ourselves a Jew boy, Daddy. Look, can we strap?
Looks, must have been quite an athlete, ladies.
Sorry. Yeah, but yes, I guess I had my share of, you know, women
like
in college.
You've always done really well socially.
Yes and no, but you know, socially, I was scared.
What do you
mean? I was always scared of people. Always scared, just afraid to be who I was. So alcohol helped with it. Being able to do voices, being able to do comedy. It's a great barrier. It's a great way to push people away.
So you use, and I have actually done this myself on occasion, used humor as a defense.
Of course.
It
absolutely
really works.
Sometimes it saved my life. It, you know, growing up, it just.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to have to defend yourself at
in
all,
college,
it's a great
yeah.
defense because it shows intelligence.
Especially
actually.
If you're a people pleaser in that, you know, aspect. People are like, hey, do your thing. Do your, you know, be silly, be stupid.
Attention.
I'm like, yeah, I'll be your idiot. You know, I'll be your deuce.
See,
I'll
you
crack
got
the jokes and I'll, I just. Don't
so
want
what
to
was
plan.
Drinking like for you in college? Were you drinking like in the morning where other people, like I have no idea. I honestly, can't imagine it. I don't know. And that's an honest question. It sounds dumb. But
I think a lot of times I drank alone. But yes, I would go out to frat parties. I would go out to other parties. I would drink, I kind of burned bridges with football too because of drinking.
What happened? Did they?
I was just, you know, I was a walk-on and we had a, you know, great head coach, good program. And, you know, he was going to give me, you know, a fair shot, you know, after the year. And he said, all you have to do is, you know, show up to the spring game. All you do is show up. And I just couldn't.
You mean you were just drunk or?
I was just scared. I was scared of that. And I instead, you know, alcohol was great. And it said, well, I'm not supposed to be successful. Afraid, being afraid of success is a huge thing.
Mm.
It's scary, you know, to do well. It's very, it's frightening. Frightening when people are like, God, you have so much potential. You have so much this. And then you realize it for a second. You go, no. I'd rather just stay down here.
Because you know,
you just don't. There's a part of an alcoholic, at least me, as an alcoholic, that's worthless. That feels absolutely worthless.
And you don't want to, it's too scary to try, say?
Sometimes it's too scary, and sometimes it's just more comfortable to say, you know, I'm a shit, and this is where I belong.
And then it's really,
I don't deserve.
It's a downward, it's a spiral, because then, like, you don't go to the tryout, and then you feel
there's
bad that you do that and stuff like that.
Yeah, I burn bridges in all kinds of places.
Did you piss people off a lot?
Sometimes I piss people off. Sometimes, you know, people...
You weren't reliable? Is that part of it?
I was reliable to an extent.
He was very early today. You're reliable.
I'm very reliable. I was here before you. I'm very reliable. I was waiting.
He's very reliable.
My tail was wagging. I was waiting.
No, he's a really reliable guy. So you might have always been reliable anyway.
You know, it's just, I think being reliable to oneself is where it comes down to. Mm. Was I reliable to myself?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to let anybody else down.
Were you letting myself down? Were you getting any feedback from people that you were having trouble with drinking? Not in college. Oh, because people don't notice that shit in college.
No,
you're in college. You're drinking.
Right, everybody did. We're in college. We're drinking. We're, you know.
So where? What? So anyway, you made it through college.
Made it through college.
And then what happened?
Got to New York. Mm-hmm. I came to New York City in 1994, spring of 94, and with my Jeep Cherokee and a U-Haul attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very lucky. I had friends waiting for me. You know, with a place. We had an entire top floor of a townhouse in Astoria for $900 altogether.
Holy shit.
Right, holy shit, right? 1994.
Well, that must have been great.
It was great. And I had really good roommates.
Yeah.
Really good. They were great buddies. Friends. Still today.
That must have been like a really fun time.
It was.
It must have been a really fun time of your life.
There was a lot of fun things about it and a lot of things I don't remember about it. I ended up getting rid of my car. I got tired of being towed.
What were you doing to make money?
Just various things in the beginning, you know, from putting up like studio lights at Lincoln Center to telemarketing to, you know, wait. I was bussing tables. I was a busboy at a major steakhouse.
An actor doing odd jobs. You were an actor doing odd jobs.
I did a lot of odd jobs, man. In college, I worked at McDonald's. I worked at Wendy's. I worked at a place called Farmore, which was like a Walmart. I did everything there was.
So what?
Landscaping. I sold knives.
You sold knives. I don't think having somebody who's drinking selling knives sounds very good.
If you see vector marketing, run.
better than guns. That's not even, we can't even joke about guns.
West Virginia.
We can't joke about guns.
No, we do not. I don't want to.
Okay. So you were,
it was in New York.
You were hanging out with your friends. Were you going on auditions or was acting part of,
I was
in
just
there
dipping.
Somewhere?
Yeah. I mean, my roommates and I were, we went to Lee Strasberg Theater Institute.
Mm-hmm.
So when we first got there. So we got that experience and, so we started at Lee Strasberg.
And then you got an MFA.
Well, I took a couple, I veered off a little bit. I became an NBC page.
Oh, that's a real job.
That was a real job.
That's not an odd job. That's an actual job.
It was $9 an hour back then, but mm-hmm. I took people on the tours.
Mm-hmm.
When I worked at tours, I got to work on the shows like Conan O'Brien or, you know, SNL. I got to work on so many different things.
Were you like, oh my God, when you got the job?
Yeah.
Were you like, oh my God, I got this job.
You had several interviews. Yeah, it is. You had a lot of interviews for this job.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
It's a very prestigious job to have.
Sure, of course.
And you can't act starstruck. So, you know,
right.
One of my jobs was what they called studio hallway stay and work at SNL. So my job was to stand between, you know, in the hallway of the green room.
Uh-huh, right.
And then another stairwell, which led to All Access. So it was a list of people who were allowed in the green room, which was nothing but a room not much bigger than the one we're in now, painted green, that overlooked the set.
Tiny.
It was a tiny room. It had a, you know, had beer in a fridge or whatever it is. But I had to stand there. And then people would, who were on that list, got to go in there. And then there were people who had what's called All Access, which is access to everything. So
like
usually
Lauren Michaels.
Right. All access to that. Or you know, Chris Farley was on the show then.
Wow, you got to.
Really nice guy.
You got to, like, so you got to meet, like, really amazing people.
I got to meet a lot of good people. He was a really nice guy.
Yeah.
You know, got to see the changing of the cast of Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
Got to see the show at its lows and highs.
Yeah.
It was exciting. I got to see auditions for Saturday Night Live. I was taking people on a tour, and I said, they are auditioning.
Wow.
For the show. Amazing. I was like,
wow. So, that is so awesome. Were you drinking then?
Of course.
So what, how?
Not during the job, but.
No, but so how did that work? Like, how does that work? How do you work in drinking when you have a job? Like what role does drinking have in your life when you have a job?
Had a big role in my life, but I didn't drink on the job.
Mm-hmm.
I did not drink on a job, but you know, afterwards we'd either go out, or if there was a SNL party, Saturday Night Live
party.
You
go to those parties?
I go to like some of those parties, and you know, and then when you have roommates, you go clubbing. Clubbing was the big thing in the 90s, you know, going clubbing, which I hated clubs, but you know, I just
drank.
Yeah. And then you tailgate, and then you would drink. You'd be like tailgating to go out to drink too. That
right,
was my thing.
Right.
My role was, I called it the 2 and 2. So, especially performing, I never drank when I was performing ever. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of skipping ahead a little bit. I did the NBC page thing, which was great experience. I didn't end up getting a job within the building, and it's great. I had a guy named Chris Salger, who was our supervisor, really good guy. I always did perfect impersonations of him. So throughout our tour route, we had like phones, and I would call, and I would make people believe that they were called to Chris's office.
Oh, that's really
like, would
funny.
You like to come down to my office? He's like, why are 20 people in my office right now? They're like, I don't know who called. You go, Pearlstein. But, you know,
that's funny.
But he said at the end of it, he said, you know, you don't belong in a building, in an office. You belong, you know, performing. That's where you belong, man.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. So hence I started working on auditioning to get an MFA, auditioning to get into graduate schools.
Uh-huh.
And I saw the Actors Studio was brand new. It was brand new. So I got in. I worked for a few months with a friend of mine on a scene to audition for. James Lipton.
Right.
So and the new school, the Actors Studio was at the new school back then. Now they've moved the pace.
And
back
James Lipton was running it.
Yes, he was. So I auditioned for him.
It's a big deal, folks. You know that TV show.
Yes.
Inside the Actors Studio.
Yes.
Yeah, it's great, actually. I love that show.
I got to see a lot of good people. So I did get in. We were the third graduating class. I got
in.
And I think that first year, my drinking was up. I was waiting tables. I was busing and waiting tables and food running. And that's the rule. When you work in a restaurant, you're waiting tables, you drink in a service bar. That's a given. Always drink in a service bar entrance.
It's a service bar.
It's right outside of the bar. So it's where you pick up your drinks to take to the tables.
Oh, and like service they have bar. It like that little area.
It's like a little tiny area.
Yeah.
And then, you know, people wouldn't finish. Here's the thing about being an alcoholic. A lot of people that wouldn't finish their wine or their, you know, they had these big bottles of wine. Well, we'd take that. You know, when they left, we would take that. And then we would drink, and then we would go over to another place, another bar after that, right after, and drink there. But I just continued. And then at the same time, I had classes starting at 9 a.m. I had, you know, for graduate school.
Hey, professional, you're kind of missing the mic. I'm surprised.
I'm so sorry about that.
No, that's good. That's a good sign. We got into it. You're moving your head around.
I'm moving my head around. I'm a bobblehead now.
So
my drinking was escalated, during the first year.
Because of the, I think,
my roommates noticed it. My friends noticed
really?
It.
Really? What did they say?
You know, I would always end up at one of my roommates. He was a doorman at a nice beer and wine bar. And I would always end up there after, you know, during near closing time. And because I knew he had the car, but I would also drink for free.
Uh-huh.
But I would pass out. He'd always say, you can't pass out in this kind of a bar here. You can't pass out.
So you would pass out like at the bar?
Yeah, I just kind of pass out and he'd wake me up. He's like, we got to get home. It just, you know what, the bottom line is I just got sick and tired of being sick and tired. I knew I had a problem during the summer, right after the first year ended. I think I was doing a musical reading of some sort, that's when my time came. That's when I'm just, long story short, I just said, you know what, I don't know how, but I can't do this anymore. I've two paths to go down, you know.
Yeah, you felt like,
if I keep doing it, because I don't understand. Whenever people didn't finish, even today, when people don't finish their drinks, I don't get it. I don't understand that.
Oh, really?
That's not the way I work.
Right.
When people leave like something in their beer glass or a wine glass, sipping wine, drives me nuts.
Right.
Or leaving stuff in a glass, don't.
Right.
Because I finish it.
Right.
I didn't drink for fun. I drank to finish. I drank to go to another place.
Right.
So, yeah.
It's a really different relationship with alcohol. Right.
So, yeah, June 3rd was my first day sober.
So you just got yourself into
a program? I had some help. There's a lot of meetings. And a friend's mom got me to my first meeting.
Oh, a friend's mom.
A friend's mom took me to my first meeting, helped me for a month. And she said, I love you. We can always talk, but you need to find a male sponsor. That's how this program works.
Right.
Go get yourself a sponsor.
Right.
A male.
Was she somebody who was going to program?
Yeah, she'd been in there for a long time.
Right.
That's why she took me on. That's why my friend said, hey, talk to my mom.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So, that was... June 3rd was 22 years.
And you haven't drank since you started?
No.
Wow. Is that unusual?
I mean, there's a lot of people that go back out.
Uh-huh.
So it is a miracle. You take it day by day. So when I first came in, I didn't understand that. I said, how are these people staying sober for years or a year or even a month? I don't understand. And I was always told, take it 5 minutes at a time if you have to.
Do you think, did you ever go to therapy?
Yeah, I've been through a lot of therapy.
So do you think that there were emotional issues behind the drinking?
Of course.
Do you understand?
Yes.
It sounds partly, I think alcoholism is partly biological, maybe?
It's biological, it's in the
gene. There's a vulnerability to it.
Of course.
But have you worked out or learned? You understand like what
I know why
what was triggering all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, look, I know why I drank. I drank to get absolutely annihilated so I don't have to deal with anything. And then even after you stop drinking, you deal with other things you deal with other, addictive things that, keep you away from dealing. But you just take it one day at a time. And you're going to, like I said, I've been through marriage.
You're on your second marriage.
Yes.
Yeah, which sounds very successful, and you have a lovely
so far
child. So far, how long have you been married?
We got married in 2016.
Oh, but you've been together.
We've been together almost 8 years.
Yeah. Well, that sounds really
interesting.
Good. Yeah.
See.
Yeah. So you had a lot of things to work out and did.
Of course.
When you stopped drinking, how did that change your perspective on your life?
Well, I mean, the first couple of years you're going through a fog. In a fog. You're trying to, the fog has to clear. You're dealing with feelings for the first time without using. Without drinking and using. You're dealing with everything for the first time.
And what is that like? Is it overwhelming?
It sucked. It really sucked. Especially the first year, 2 years, and still in the MFA program and dealing with that.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard because the insecurity, your comfort zone is gone.
Mm.
So now you have to start all over. Emotionally, it's like you're a kid again. Mm-hmm. You're a little kid again.
Mm-hmm. So did you have to, were you negotiating the world in a way? Were you were you managing it on your own, say, and like getting through, like acting normal every day, but It was really painful.
I never acted normal. I've never acted normal in my life.
Well, yeah, I mean, no, but normal, I mean, for you.
Sure.
Functional, you know.
You learn.
No one expects
that's
you
what
normal.
The That's what meetings are for. That's what Evan Esponza was for. So you can get through this. Mm-hmm. Looking at things differently. Mm-hmm. A toolbox. For me, the program, it's an entire toolbox. It's reading what we call the big book, the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's going through the steps, the 12 steps. It's going through the steps. And it's also helping somebody else go through the steps.
Ah.
Also taking on, somebody else who's struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And taking them through it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, when you're helping somebody else, you're out of your own head.
Right.
And you're doing service for other people and you're helping yourself at the same time.
Yeah, that is like...
You have to show up.
And that is actually one of the ways they have proven that people actually do wind up feeling more positive is by helping other people.
Yes.
I mean, they've got, they got statistics to show that, science behind that.
Yes.
As a father, that must be something that you think about, right?
Yeah. It's one of the miracles is even my ex-wife never saw me drunk.
Really?
Never.
How
I got sober before that.
Because you were sober.
Right. And
got sober.
My son, my wife right now, my wife and my son have never seen me drunk.
Mm-hmm.
Never.
Wow.
And that's, that's a miracle.
And you're proud of that, aren't you?
Of course.
Yeah, that's huge.
Now, do I worry, when my son's taking children's Tylenol, when he's sick or whatever it is, and he's licking that little shot glass thing, there's a part of me that's going, I'll see you here soon. No, but. It's great. And do I wonder that, gosh, does he have the gene? Or what's that going to,
Yeah.
Of course, sometimes.
Yeah.
You don't know.
Well, but also it sounds like you're giving him a pretty stable life.
Yes. And he's got a dad that he's proud of. He's got a dad that's the goofy actor dad of all the parents.
Yeah, you must be the most fun dad ever.
I try. I'm the goofy actor father. Yes.
I saw a video. When I was researching, there was a really cute video. Stalking. I've been stalking you since, when is that, 2009?
Oh, Jesus.
I just pretend I'm asking these questions. But so I saw a really cute video of him in a car, in a Jeep. Was it a Jeep car?
It was an SUV, yes.
SUV, like a child size SUV.
Oh, his car. Yeah, car. Yes, his car.
Is that
his
car?
It was. He's grown now. But
he had a car.
He had a little car.
How did that car work? Was it?
We pushed it.
You pushed it.
We pushed it.
Oh,
that's how it worked.
Oh, I was like, is that a motorized
He's
car?
He's like an infant.
Did Ken give his kid a motorized car?
No, not that.
So what is it like working on the pilot? I mean, you wrote the pilot.
Yes, it took me a while.
Some of this stuff you've had to relive, or some of this, do you feel like you've healed through it, or what's it like? And you're not the star. You're not playing you have an actor, right? Is that right? I should know
Well,
that.
No, I am playing.
You are playing yourself.
Well, I'm playing the character Eli.
But
I'm playing
character.
The lead character. Yes, it's a character.
But it's not
word for word me.
Right.
But a lot of parts of me are in it.
Mm-hmm. And you are the star, of course. Yeah.
I am the star. I'm the lead.
You are the lead.
I'm the lead. I'm the co-lead.
As they say. And
the bright shining star.
Bright shining star. So, but do you feel a certain vulnerability? Do you feel like you're exposing yourself?
Sure.
And what's that like? Is that feel more exposed than you have been in other things?
To a point, yes. I mean, when you write something, when you're writing, this was only the second piece that I wrote, but I started writing this 2 years ago. I was working with a mentor, a really good writer.
Somebody, yeah.
Right, because I had written a short film before this.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote and was, a co-star in this short film.
Yeah, I read about that, and it got a bunch of festivals. Say the name of it.
It's called January.
January.
And it was in a couple of festivals.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
We shot it in 2 days because it was part of a challenge.
So this isn't your first writing.
It's not my first.
Yeah.
But that was my first, and it was 15 minutes.
2 days.
We shot it in 2 days with with one camera, and, but it was a deeply emotional. It was some elements of comedy in it, but it was a deeply heavy, heavy short film. And then I just kind of just took a, you know, 2015, 2016 election came along, toxic, and I started trying to write several different things, and then I started working with this mentor, and I, you know, we went back and forth on ideas, and I'm like, you know what? I have an idea. I started to grab an idea of where I wanted this to go, what this story was, you know, how I saw things, how I saw these people and these, and I just started, and this guy was great. His name was Nick Job, and he was a good mentor, and he pushed me, you know, he really pushed me. He said, you have to learn to raise the stakes in each scene that you're writing, and it would drive me nuts. He said, nope, the stakes aren't high enough. Go back.
Were you, in other words, he's pushing you to reveal yourself more, to make yourself more vulnerable in a certain way.
But the scene structure too, learning as well. So he moved. I accumulated 40 pages. He moved. I was casting people that I knew. I had a picture of people that I knew who could play these parts. So I sent it to a friend of mine, a lady named Julie Hayes, who's an amazing actress. Really, really good writer too. She plays my agent.
Yes, I love that role. I mean, I love. Great. I mean, I only saw the trailer, but
I guess I knew when I had like 40 something pages. I shot it over to her. I said, you know, this is something I've been working on a little bit. Here's where I picture your part, and here's all these other things, and let me know what you think. And I half expected her to bash me, and which was because she's blunt. But I got this huge long text from her. It's like, wow, this is really fucking good. This is fun. I love each and every character. Let's sit down and talk about it. Let's meet.
Wow.
And she printed out what I had. And before I knew it, I had 80 pages. I had a reading at my apartment. At 18 actors. I had 80 pages at the time.
18 actors. Wow.
And I had 40 people in my apartment.
Wow.
And we had a reading. We had a reading. And nobody wanted to leave. They all kept, because we had a talk back, and people just kept talking about it.
Yeah.
And it went from there, and it's been a journey, because I knew nothing about producing.
Yeah, that's
nothing about producing.
That's a big deal.
I mean, so you go through the pains, you go through learning experiences, and then I finally found the right team. I have two women who get shit done. One of them is my producer, Jen Plotsky, and my director, Colleen Davey James.
Good, you got a woman director.
That's
women
right, I got a female done. Team. I got a female team, and that's why.
Women get shit done.
Yes, they do.
You know, it's true. It's true. So in the process of doing this, has it given you a different perspective on your own life?
Yes.
And in what way?
I mean, so many different ways. It's given me new avenues to look at where I can go, but also writing this too has just been writing it from my heart. Opening, there's a lot of recovery in it.
Yeah,
there's some recovery in it, and you know, my character's in a meeting in one of the scenes, and I had to write another character who we, you know, I don't want to give it away, but I had to write another character for this other guy who is fresh out of rehab and struggling. And then I had to write a whole monologue for my character relating to that guy, but also sharing his heart, sharing his difficulties, struggles, and the fear.
So do you think that going through, I mean, that's a huge process of getting a TV pilot done in a, you know, at the level of production and professionalism and all that.
It's not easy.
And also, there is a GoFundMe to help finish it up and get it into the festivals. That's why. Why don't we say that now? Why we have the opportunity?
Sure.
It's How Am I Doing TV? Oh well, go to howamidoingtv.com to see the trailer, learn more about the pilot. Is the GoFundMe also on there, or is that a different thing?
GoFundMe is a different thing. The GoFundMe is just if you go on GoFundMe, go to How Am I Doing. And it's on there.
Yeah, Ken Perlstein, you'll find it.
Yep,
folks.
You'll find me.
You're smart. You listen to the show.
I'm smart.
You can do
I know
it.
Things.
They can do it. You can do it. And any amount is helpful. Any amount is, because it always, it's always really like good to feel encouraged by getting anybody to give you anything.
And thank you, Lisa.
I think this is meaningful.
Thank you.
I'm glad if I can help. No, I'm glad I can. Glad I can help. I think like it's occurring to me, like I'm thinking about like all of the discipline and drive and everything
and the ups and the downs and still sticking with it.
But also what it takes to get through AA and sobriety. And I think like
just one day at a time,
some of that resolve must have really helped you throughout your life, and particularly in this project and a lot of other things. Do you think so?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. A lot of, you know, when you have that toolbox and you're striving just to be the very best you can be, that's all we're trying to do, is just the very best that we can. Not perfect.
And do you think that when you're in, you know, the people that you've been able to relate to in AA, is there a certain kind of intimacy there that helps you? Because I've been in group therapy. It's not the same. But I'm just like, in my experience in group therapy, when people, like, we're always trying to like make ourselves like everything's fine when we're out in the world. But what really draws you into other people is when somebody says, hey, this really sucks. And then everybody goes, oh my God, I know. And they're like, you feel so much closer. You learn how to be closer to people. Sure. Do you think that's helped you with your relationships?
Of course. It's helped me to become such a better listener to other people.
Huh.
But also, yeah, I mean, but an understanding of, because we're, you know, I'll speak for myself, as an alcoholic, we are self-absorbed people. Uh-huh. We are self-servicing, we are so self-absorbed.
Is that,
you know,
what does that mean?
I mean, we got our own thing going on. I don't have time for anything else. But what this program, you know, has taught me is that if you don't make time for anybody else, then you can't help yourself.
Mm.
So, you gotta be accountable, and you have to be accountable for people. So when you're, you know, when I was out there, you know, using and drinking, I didn't want to be accountable for anybody but me.
Huh.
But I'm a guy, but I have to be accountable. I have a family, I have a kid,
right?
I have a wife,
right?
I have things. I have this pilot. I have an LLC. I have to be accountable.
Right.
I have to show up.
Right.
You can't just hide under the covers with a bottle.
Right. Right. Huh. Interesting. It's interesting. It's a lot. Wow. It sounds like that was a really hard life. And I was going to say about how alcoholics they're really in their own, like what you were saying about how they have their own thing. So it's really hard. You don't actually have a lot of relationships or real relationships.
I do. I have a lot of good relationships.
Now you do.
Of course.
But I mean, as an alcoholic, it's hard to have a real relationship.
Well, when you're out there drinking,
depending
on what you're doing, when you're drinking and using, you know, your relationships are skewed a little bit.
Yeah.
My relationships were of people, places, and things were based around when my next drink would be.
Mm. But I was also going to say that I think the thing about art is, this is what I think. I think that in order to make really good art, You have to really be able to suffer. Expose yourself.
Yes.
Not suffer.
I know, I'm kidding.
Yeah. You have to take yourself really fucking seriously, okay?
Right.
No, but I think like a lot of art is getting to the real truth about life and who you, and in order to do that, you have to know who you are.
Right.
So do you think that if you're an alcoholic, you can also be a really good creative person?
Of course.
I mean, a using alcoholic.
Yeah.
Really?
There's a lot of alcohol that are a lot of functioning alcoholics, and there's a lot of alcoholics that never got in recovery who are very creative people, of course.
And very
sick. And very sick.
And very successful.
Very successful, talented and sick, you know. I'm still sick, but you know, but yeah, sure. This, you could be a drunk and be successful. You could be sick, but it's just, mm-hmm. and sometimes you can't. Sometimes you lose everything.
Yeah, it's a big fucking gamble. It's a big fucking gamble.
It's a big fucking gamble.
So, anyway, well, we have 5 minutes left.
Okay.
So I just want to say that I think you're a great example of humanity, Ken.
No.
I really do.
Thank you.
I think that you've done a lot of really, I think this pilot is going to be really great. I think a lot of people are going to be able to relate to it. I mean, you don't have to be an alcoholic in order to have demons that, you don't have to be literally an alcoholic to have a lot of demons that get in your way. I mean, I've been there with depression.
Of course. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I can relate.
You know, it doesn't have to be just that. But I think and here's the other thing. It took you 20 years to get to this point. And I think a lot of people have to understand that, like, you think, especially in acting or entertainment, you think that by the time you're 30, if you haven't made it, did you feel like that when you were younger as an actor?
I mean, sometimes I thought, oh my God, why am I doing this? But when you spend the money you spend on a master's degree, which I'm still paying off, for me, there was no turning back.
Mm-hmm.
Other people that I, you know, went to graduate school with, they, very few are still in it. And then some people found other avenues of that they're happy with making a living, and that's great.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
For me personally, there was nothing else I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing else I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I've done what I've had to do sometimes. I've been in the corporate world. I've made a lot of money in inside sales.
What's that?
I hated it. Inside sales is like, you know, email telemarketing. I started a sales team at one point after my marriage. And I made a lot of money, but I was not happy.
Yeah.
You know, you're 8.5-9 hours making 220 calls a day.
Well, acting skills can certainly transfer to sales skills.
Of course, that's what helped me.
Yeah, right.
But doing that.
Yeah.
3 years.
So see that, guys? Here, we got somebody who's been through some shit, and now they're happy.
I've been through a lot of shit.
So don't give up.
No, don't give up.
Don't give up. Don't fucking quit.
Don't quit. You know,
just don't
really
quit.
Don't. Seriously,
that's what we're
don't.
Trying to say, right? Don't quit.
Hugs, not drugs. No.
Yeah. And now you have, do you think, and what's your son interested in? What's he like?
Oh my goodness. He's hilarious.
Really?
He's
has a
funny.
Really good sense of humor.
He's very creative. He's extremely smart. He's so smart.
Yeah.
Really funny. I'll tell you a quick funny story.
Okay. We have 30 seconds.
30 star. Okay. His bedtime routine, he told me that because we still save quarters, he basically stole our quarters, put it in his pretend register, and then he bribed me. I said, you could only watch one show. He said, no, I want to watch two. I said, only one. He goes, how about a quarter? He brought a quarter back. He said, how about another quarter for another show? I said, where'd you get the quarter? He goes, you. I'm like, so he already was taught embezzlement. That's the short
answer.
What
do you do? Do you take all the quarters back?
I take the quarters back, put them back in a jar, and then he takes them back to his register.
I love it.
The cycle.
I love it. I love it.
The
Trump School of Business. It's all in the family.
Yes.
So anyway, thanks so much for listening to, for being here, Ken.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks to all the listeners. Go to radiofreebrooklyn.org. And check us out. We've got a lot going on, monthly mixers, podcasts, all sorts of stuff. And stick around because we've got great programming this afternoon. So much great music and talk. And it's, you know, Elon Danziger's on after this. He's my favorite. Stick around and listen to Lost and